recent French poetry. Well, there isn't very much to say. France, as you may know, if you know anything about it, is in a serious state of doldrums, literarily speaking. Most of the people who are important writers, the young writers of France, are my age or older. But there is an interesting development, which is right up my alley, which I think might interest you, and that is that a great number of poets, young poets, are writing for, not exactly the café chantant, but the café chantant idiom, the women and men who have become famous, like Brassens and Greco and Montero, and of course, all of you know Edith Piaf. There is a record, Piaf sings Mac Orlan, a record, Greco sings Carco. These are older men. And I will play you in a moment, I've lost it, Do I Chant Seguer? Seguer is the man who ran Poésie this year and that, you know, 41, 42, all during the war as a kind of underground magazine, and who is now the most important poetry publisher in France and a very fine poet himself, a man in his early 40s. I'm sorry I don't have things by younger people, but as I say, the situation in France today is such that the average young intellectual would make Gregory Corso look like the Encyclopedia Britannica, and they're just not interested in doing anything. They're real nihilists. They're far beyond being beat. Or they're quite conventional. Of course, a similar situation prevailed in America until fairly recently. But I'm going to play first probably the greatest chanteuse of the Café Chantant, Germaine Montero, singing a song of Aristide Briand, a poem. And this will give you, this is probably the most perfect expression of this idiom. And it's called, Briand was a man who ran a nightclub in the days of Toulouse-Lautrec. There's a picture of him by Toulouse-Lautrec on the cover. But he was also a poet of some stature, and he took off from similar work which had been done earlier in the 19th century by the poet Charles Cros, not C-R-O-W, but C-R-O-S. This is called Roduse de Bourges, it's all about a girl who wanders along the water, the shore beside the water of the Seine, of course, makes the crane. That is, she does not have a protector. It's the song of a lonely woman of the street. In other words, it is perfectly in the idiom of the American blues. I didn't work this thing. But as I say, this man is a poet, not primarily a...
Oh,
There's a poem by Mike McClure about the expression on my face while I listen to that song. Now this is Pierre Segers with Douay singing to the harp, The Lovers. Curious people, those lovers who live beyond time. I'll travel with the wind and burn by themselves all alone. What do you turn it to 45? Does anybody know how this thing works? Oh, here it is. Here it is. Hang on.
Curieux de gens que les amants qui vivent en dehors du temps, ils voyagent avec le vent.
Well, this book won the Prix Apollinaire last year, and all of these songs are sort of sub-popular songs. That is, with the there's music in this edition. And Segers is one of the, I would say, four or five most important French poets in his 40s. There are only a small handful of people who can compare with him. I think this is very significant, and I wish that very much that things like this would be done in America.
Incidentally, any young woman who can sing well and who speaks perfect French would like to go on the road with me while I do jazz poetry and she sings these numbers. We could make a great deal of money. It'd be fun. Now I'll do a piece of my own that I made last night with Lionel Hampton.
Under the fireflies.
There's a singer who sings first, and I've done this deliberately to give you the contrast. Set up, but we couldn't get in. There was another class in there.
Pretty compact.
You'll see the point of why I prefer jazz poetry to the lyric of the popular ballad. Incidentally, can't sing, but that's
not why you just do. You never seem to want my romancing. The only time you hold me is when we're dancing. I don't know why I love you. I don't know why, but I do.
This is called a contrast for teaching purposes.
Do not talk anymore. Do not speak. Do not break silence until we are weary of each other. Let our fingers run like steel, carve the contours of our bodies gold. Do not speak. My face sinks into the closet summer of your hair. The sound of the bees stops. Stillness falls like a cloud. Be still. Let your body fall away into the awe-filled silence of a fulfilled summer. Back, infinitely away. Our lips weak, faint with stillness.
I guess you get the point. I didn't really expect to do this tape. Lionel called up last night and said, get down here, man, hurry up. So while everybody's moving chairs and the dispatcher, you can't hear it down there, somehow we screened it out, was calling in the Longshore Hall, we managed to put together the better part of a record. How much time have I got? What time is it? That's right, just falls right. Poem written in Venice, we can take off from the musical introduction. 10 years and it's still on the radio. La Vie en Rose spills out of a dozen windows onto the canal. A woman and her son in a vegetable barge sing it. The man polishing the prow of his gondola sings it while his dog wags his tail in time to the music. Children playing hopscotch sing it. More radios join in. Across the canal, beyond the iron bars of the women's prison, 100 pure voices of pickpockets and prostitutes start to sing it. It's just like being in church. The next number is Ciao, Ciao, Bambina. There are no images here. This is Provence. The end of winter. We were living, we spent the last year living at the spot from which the commonest paintings of Mont Saint-Victoire by Cézanne are painted. There's a little marker at the corner of the lot that says, ici. When Mary, my oldest daughter, saw it, she almost fainted away, and then she discovered that she was going to go to a school which said, E.C., the great
Provençal painter Cézanne was born. So, anyway, just imagine that you're in the Metropolitan Museum looking at the picture of Provençal Victoire. In the dark, I mean, you can't see it, see? There are no images here in the solitude, only the night and its stars, which are relationships rather than images. Shifting darkness, strains of feeling, lines of force, webs of thought, no images. Only night and time aging, the night in its darkness, just motion in space in the dark. It is a night full of darkness and space and stars and the hours going by and time going by and the night growing old and all the webs and nets of relationships changing. And it is spring night in Provence, here where I am, and under the half moon the almond blossoms are ready to burst. Before noon the blossoms will open here by the peach-colored house amongst the steely pines and the gray limestone cliffs. Now the buds are round and tight in the dim moonlight in the night that stretches on forever, that had no beginning and that will never end. And it doesn't mean anything. It isn't an image of something. It isn't a symbol of something else. It is just an almond tree in the night by the house in the woods, by a vineyard, under the setting half moon in Provence in the beginning of another spring. In the morning, all the almond trees are blooming over Provence like they were blooming in a popular song. Everywhere in the uplands and the woods where the old trees have shattered the ancient walls, everywhere by the pale ochre ruined houses, the almond trees are blooming. In the dry, bright February, all day I walk in the lifeless forest. Nothing moves. Once in a great while, some magpies rustle and cry off in the trees somewhere. Once in a great while, the smell of a polecat or a deserted badger hole. Every few hundred meters, there is a high wall of dry-laid stone stretching away out of sight through the forest, fencing ruin from ruin. Roofless houses, broken walls, dry canals, roads that go nowhere. Even the shooting blinds are deserted. Everywhere there are almond trees just out in bloom this morning and black, jagged, dead olives with silver-green shoots coming up around them. No sound, only the movement of leaves and stones. This is was written in Vicenza on Monteberico, a hill above the town of Vicenza, which you may know, if that's your specialité, is practically built by the great architect Palladio and his immediate disciples. If you don't know who Palladio was, you probably know the Monticello, the home of Jefferson, which is on the nickel. That is practically an exact copy of the farm next door to where I was living, the rotunda of the Villa Valmarana. Under the orchards, under the tree-strung vines, little blue figures are making hay. High on the steep hillsides above Palladio's drowsy villas and Tiepolo's swirling walls. On the highest field, they are still cutting with swinging scythes. Down below, they are tossing the long swaths of hay to cure in sun. Further down, they are cocking it or carrying it off in two-wheeled donkey carts. The Venetian plain vanishes in haze. The nearby Alps are in definite blue smudges capped with faint streaks of orange snow. Clouds of perfume roll up the hillside in waves. All the birds sing, all the flowers bloom. Here at a stone table like this, on a little hill like this, in a circle of cypress and olive like this, the infinite visited Leopardi and ravished him and carried him off in the deep summer. It would carry me off, too, if I knew where I wanted to go, or if I just wanted to go nowhere at all. The reference is to Leopardi's most famous poem, L'Infinito, which is translated in a book of mine. I don't remember which one. Thank you.
I have a group of blues. One of them's on here, but I don't play it. Somebody wants to stay afterwards, then here's the rest of it. A girl in a torn chemise weeps by a dirty window. Jaws are punched in the streets. A cat is sick in the gutter. Dogs bark up night-bound alleys. There's nothing like the sorrow of the jukeboxes at dawn. Dice girls going home, whores eating chop suey, pimps eat chili mac, drowsy flat feet, ham and eggs. Dawn of labor, dawn of life, the awakening noises of the old sacrifices. The snow blows down the bare street ahead of the first streetcar. The lovers light cigarettes and part with burning eyes and go off in the daylight. Getting more modernistic. This wouldn't be for Lionel. The sea will be deep, the eye will be deep, the last bell has been deep. The iceberg has been cold, the nail has been cold, the hungry whore was cold. The jungle was fierce, the tooth was fierce, the mistress of the bum is fierce. The plate of tripe is shallow, the omelette in the pan is shallow, shallow is the wisdom of the ages. The hawk in the zenith knows, the mole under the spade knows, the curly brain knows too. Don't you forget it. I think these might do better for Dave Tough of my own day, or Chico Hamilton, without Freddie Kidd. They don't go with that. Gray is the Arctic, gray is the sea, gray is the heart, gray is the bird in the tree. Red is the sun, red is the robin, red is the heart, red is the axe in the tree. Blue is the star, blue is the gull, blue is the heart, blue is the air in the tree. Black is the tongue, black is the vulture, black is the heart, black is the hanged girl in the tree. And another blues. Oh, that first one I read was called 32nd Street Blues, a 32nd and State Cold Morning Blues about streetcars and the Chili Mac. This one's called Married Man Blues. I didn't want it, you wanted it. Now you've got it, you don't like it. You can't get out of it now. Pork and beans, diapers to wash, too poor for the movies, too tired to love. There's nothing we can do. Hot stenographers on the subway, the grocery boy's got a big one, we can't do anything about it. You're only young once, you've got to die when your time comes. That's how it is, nobody can change it. Guys in big cars whistle, freight trains moan in the night. We can't get away with it. That's the way life is. Everybody's in the same fix. It'll never be any different. I'm afraid. I hope you know about Proust's Madeleine, you know, and he dips this crumpet into the tea and tastes it, and back to him comes all of Cambrai and his childhood. A Madeleine is a sort of French crumpet. You know about crumpets, you know, when Errol Flynn was sued, you know, by those two girls. Well, judge said to the girl, something. He said, did the defendant ever call you any pet names? And she said, yes. He used to call me his little strumpet. And the courtroom laughed, and the judge had to pound with his gavel for quite a while. And he said, Miss, do you know what a strumpet is? And she said, well, sure, Your Honor. It's a kind of English bun. Well, this is about a poker chip, Proust's Madeleine. Somebody has given my baby daughter a box of old poker chips to play with. One day she hands me one while I'm sitting with my tired brain at my desk. It is red. On it is a picture of an elk's head and the letters BPOE, a chip from a small town elk's club. I flip it idly in the air and catch it and do a coin trick to amuse my little girl. Suddenly everything slips aside. I see my father doing the very same thing, whistling Beautiful Dreamer, his breath smelling faintly of whiskey and cigars. I can hear him coming home drunk from the Elks Club in Elkhart, Indiana, bumping the chairs in the dark. I can see him in the hospital dying of cirrhosis of the liver and stomach ulcers and pneumonia, or, as he used to prophesy, crooked cards and straight whiskey, slow horses and fast women. How much more time I got? Oh, John. This is a Californiana, I guess. It's written in Sequoia National Park. It's called Homer in Basic. There is an edition of Homer now in Basic English, and it was my daughter Mary's favorite book at the time this was written. Where's my other daughter? Lying on the bench there, looking like Theda Barrow. Stay there. Oh, come on, I don't care. Homer in Basic. Glitter of Nausicaa's embroideries, flashing arms and heavy-hung maiden hair, doing the laundry, the wind brisk in the bright air of the Mediterranean's day. Odysseus, hollow cheek, wild-eyed, bursts from the bushes. Mary sits by the falling water reading Homer while I fish for mottled brook trout in the sun-mottled riffles. They are small and elusive. The stream is almost fished out. Water falls through shimmering, paneled light between the red sequoias over granite and limestone, under green ferns and purple lupin. Time was I caught huge old trout in these pools and riffles. These are 3 years old at the very most. Mary is 7, Homer is her favorite author. It took me a lifetime of shames and wastes to understand Homer. She says, aren't those gods terrible? All they do is fight like those angels in Milton and play tricks on the poor Greeks and Trojans. I like Aias and Odysseus best. They are lots better than those silly gods. Like the ability to paint, she will probably outgrow this wisdom. It too will wither away as she matures, and a whole lifetime will be spent getting it back. Now she teaches Catherine the profound wisdom of 7, and Catherine responds with the profound nonsense of 3. Gray-haired in granite mountains, I catch baby fish. 10 fish and Homer and the 2 little girls pose for a picture by the 20-foot-wide cinnamon-red bole of a sequoia. As I snap the camera, it occurs to me that this tree was as big as the pines of Olympus, not just before Homer sang, but before Troy ever fell or Odysseus had ever sailed from his home. I feel bound, due to Ruth's annoying publicity, to read only new and unpublished work. So I'll read from something that has never appeared in a book. In my adolescence, between the ages of about, I was a terrible precocity, you know. I was running a speakeasy when I was considerably younger than anybody in this room. And in my teens, I wrote this poem. It's kind of Proustian, as a matter of fact. It's about 2 men, 2 aspects of a personality, actually, of course, 2 projections of myself, 2 brothers,
twins, Thomas and Sebastian Damascan, who live in up the Hudson in a Palladian Greek Revival house. The house actually exists. It's across the river from East Park, from where the Roosevelts live. Hyde Park, I mean. It's in West Park. Well, I put the book aside. I was never able to publish it. It was considered to be too modernistic back in the 20s. And Lawrence Lipton, whom I hadn't seen in a great many years, showed up, and I discovered that he knew almost all of it by heart, which is very flattering indeed. And he took it and sent it to the Quarterly Review of Literature, who published it, and he wrote a long piece at the back of it all about it and me, one of the more dignified utterances of Lawrence Lipton, a man who is not a specialist in that mood. And I'll read little pieces of it. I'll read pieces that have a little connection with this. One brother eventually vanishes into the West, and the other brother settles down in the milieu, the métier in Chicago. Anyway, don't forget I was 16. I won a big prize for this last winter after I got it published and was in France, and one day a check showed up in the mail, quite a substantial amount, given me by a thing called the Long View Foundation, which is run by Arch Digest and Alan Barr and Alfred Barr, I mean, and Harold Rosenberg. So I'm quite flattered. Maybe it's good. I don't know. Anyway, I was just a child when I wrote this. Heaven is full of definite stars and crowded with modest angels robed in tubular neuter folds of pink and blue. Their feet tread doubtless on that utter hollowness with never a question of the ineluctable modality of the invisible. Busy, orderly, content to ignore the coal pockets in the galaxy, dark nebulae, and black broken windows into space. Youthful minds may fret infinity, moistly disheveled, poking in odd corners for unsampled vocations of the spirit while the flesh is strong. Experience sinks its roots in space, Euclidean warped or otherwise. The will constructs rhomboids, nonagons, and paragons in time to suit each taste. Or if not the will, then circumstance. History demands satisfaction and never lacks, with or without help, from the subjects of its curious science. The sheep are passing in the snow, their hooves a clatter on the frozen marsh. Before them and behind them go the waiting shepherds, tall and bent. And Thomas, with a narrow light, comes out and watches by the gate, and muses in the turgid night, and goes into the house again. The library is calm and prim, the shepherds and the sheep have passed, and Botticelli ladies, slim and hyperthyroid, grace the walls. So I'm just taking little bits out of this. In the deep blue winter evening, the homeward crowd murmurs and hurries and rearranges itself to the color of signal lights and shrilling whistles. Sebastian disengages himself and walks in the cold, smoky twilight of Central Park, spotted with week-old dirty snow, and stands to watch the skaters skating there beneath the acrid revelation of 40 floodlights. Northward, many night-bound miles gathering the winter about it, Damascus keeps the long January darkness. Once in a long while, far off, men move, very small with very small bright lanterns, and the frosted breath of old dogs clouds their footsteps as they fall. Foxes on the mountains go delicate,
across the snow on sly fox errands. Haitian drums are African. They were actually Dave Tuff. Haitian drums are African and horns from New Orleans. She rolls her buttocks like kelp on the sea surge, her taffy in a churn. Rhinestones cover her bee-stung pubis and perch on each nipple. Drums roll as she rolls her belly in her eyes. Grove or colonnade, porch or garden, white, blue, and silver garments and long, carefully tended beards and hands. Sebastian paints a Rousseau landscape, gnarled pine and giant dogwood, paths of pink coral and stone moon bridges over obese goldfish, figures by another hand, the school of Athens. He waits for her act to end. She smiles a warm domestic smile. The band explodes. The rhinestones fall. A polar wind blows down South State Street under the northern lights. The taxi bores into the Rousseau landscape of warm domesticity. The figures are by another hand. That was a strange game of chess she played in Uxmal. That's Uxmal, the ruins, you know, in Mexico, a long time ago. Her fingers move out from her body and dissolve like faint wisps of gaseous gold. Her head jerks, the black lacquered eyes stay still. An impenetrable black surface falls from them between her and the musicians. The music is lost in an illimitable night-bound valley. Her flesh unbraids itself like a rope. The metal melts and flows away. Brown, brown, brown is the color of my true love's skin. Her lips are sweeter than the full-blown rose. Her eyes are sad where love is entered in. Graceful and wise before my eyes she goes. Her learned body and her childish ways possess all my mind and all my days. Maxine, Uxmal, Conarchy, or Ajanta, his walls have fallen, his painted beauties are yellow dust forever now. This little episode runs through here like a little story. Pick it up. Sebastian said, I am the master of the pattern of my life. Freedom is the knowledge of necessity. That evening when her act was over, she said, my mother's sick. I've got to go see her. She sat in the cab calling her flesh back from the public, squeezing the orchestra out of it and offering it to him. They bought some things to take. Self-conscious for once, Sebastian stood like a movie gent in the gas-lit cubicle, the hamper on the single kitchen chair, a sacred heart in an old calendar with a lone wolf on the walls. The old negress like a scrap of lumber under the thin cover, huge candy eyes wet with admiration, the face like plum-colored wood in the gaslight. She was obviously dying and going to be very hard to kill. Circumstance had embalmed her long ago. The most industrious worm would never penetrate her. No corruption take her dead, as no corruption could take her living. Maxine fed her fried chicken and a hot peach fried pie and black-eyed peas. She was too weak to sit. Sebastian held her propped up, the one hard pillow in his lap. They left her a cup of steaming coffee laced with gin on the chair beside her bed. She's pretty sick, Sebastian said. How long's she been this way? Maxine said, a couple years. They danced together to the same band on the phonograph in her flat. She said, I want to do my act just for you, like I can never do it in the club. I'll do it wonderful. Saturday night, rain falls in the slums, rain veils the tired, hurrying faces.
sordid and beautiful in the rain. Sebastian walks, puzzled in the rain. This is the macrocosm. On these materials it subsists. And the microcosm, this is the very thing. There is no self that suffers rebirth. Few triglyphs of Stonehenge still stand there in that immense, windy, night-bound plain. It is cold after the summer rain. This is the place, she says. Let's eat here. She turns against him, warm and firm, rain on her brown cheeks and odorous hair. When he got home, his cheeks were bronzed, too, as though with fever rather than sun. His beard grizzled, his hair thinner. The old dog discovered him and died. The evil rivals died. The web flew wide. And this was the little brother, the holy comedian, offering him the password at which all rusted hinges fall. This is the place where knowledge was so close to poplars and the stones. And the last verse ends with Thomas, the brother, whom you haven't heard about. Thomas looks out over the valley, far off in the low mists and fireflies, the lights along the railroad track change. Then the whistle comes as distant as a star, and finally the distant roar. Like a diamond necklace falling through the long, somber valley, the lighted cars pulsating and slipping away, and the headlight twisting into the dimness like a cold needle. All so far away, not like a toy train, but like some bright microorganism, the night train to Omaha goes by. Then Thomas quiets the zebra dun, tends the bannock and the tea, and turns the bacon. Gray, low shapes of night bulk slow and make their own horizon. White ash flakes fall from the heart of the fire, now afar, now near, the Chuck Wills widow's call. Thomas smokes and spits into the fire. Bats cry the creaking of the 100 tiny closing doors of silence. Thank you. When people do that, I always feel like the Chinese. I want to applaud back.